Welcome to Talking Junk.
I'm your host, Jason Melendez.
Live now every week on Fridays.
Talking Junk.
A multitude of professionals in different aspects, different walks of life.
You have to come on and talk junk like a normal person.
Seems like that's becoming a running gag. I'm getting my own intros mixed up. Welcome to Talking Junk, the podcast that comes to you live every Friday night from YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, and Twitter. We're here today by ourselves. Talin is working on something especial, but we have a wonderful guest for you tonight, as always. He is one of the founders of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. You know, we've all seen that and wanted to stuff our faces a couple times with some of those meals they were showing there. But he's also the author of the book Food Americana. So let's have him on, Mr. David Page. How you doing, David?
I'm good, Jason. Thanks for having me. And by the way, you must have spent your whole year's graphics budget on that open. There was stuff flying through the air. I was blinded.
Yeah, well, we're trying to do it big with these live podcasts and show everybody that talking junk is virtually untouchable.
There you go.
So how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. I'm excellent.
How'd that bottle of wine treat you?
I stopped halfway through. I had a nice bottle of Josh Cabernet. It's hard to find a red that my wife likes, so when I brought a bottle of this home the other night, Roberta said she loved it, so I immediately bought a case.
Oh, yeah. And you got to buy
a case. We're working our way through that. Yeah, that's fine. But the evening's nice. It's great.
So why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself for the people who might not know who you are, sir?
Okay. My best known credit is probably creating Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and then executive producing it for the first 11 seasons. But I've been a journalist I'm going to be 67 next month. I started 52 years. Most of that in TV news, where I spent a fair amount of time internationally for NBC, and then I came back to the States, became a show producer for NBC and then ABC. At one point, I was the senior investigative producer of 2020. I was the line producer of GMA, which means in rotation with two other line producers. Every third week, the show is yours, subject to sign off from an executive producer who luckily was not that comfortable in the control room. So you could just look over and say, oh, we'll talk about that later. After that, I opened my own production company, created Diners, and after I left Diners, I did a syndicated series called Beer Geeks, all about craft beer. And my latest project has been the book Food Americana, in which I ask and answer the question, what is American cuisine?
Now, before we get into that, because it's already making me hungry, why don't we clarify for the people out there who thought Guy was the creator of Diners.
Guy's the star.
I
created the show. The network, I said to them, who are you thinking of for a host? They said, we want you to use this guy, Guy Fieri, whom I had never heard of. They told me he had just won the second annual Food Network Star competition. I nodded sagely, but was unaware that there was such a thing. So I went online and looked at the guy and thought to myself, I'm screwed because here's this like cartoon man child with insane hair and short pants and flip flops. But he turned out while he was green at television, he was a very good quick study. And frankly, the most naturally talented TV performer I've ever worked with. So it didn't take very long to get him up to speed. And he's been the host of the show ever since.
And it's still running?
Yeah, I left after season 11. They're now in season 30-something.
Wow.
Yeah, what's funny about that is they never expected the show to do well. They picked it up as a special, thinking that it would keep Guy in front of the public while they waited for a couple of proposals to come in from some big-time, well-known production companies. Well, the special rated well, and then the proposals from the big boys did not please them. So almost because they had nothing else, they picked Diners up for a short first season run. And after the episodes started to rate well, they still tamped down my expectations. One of the executives warned me, look, we really don't think this thing is good for more than a season or two, because, you know, how many restaurants are there?
Billions.
Yeah, well, there's a great Hollywood screenwriter. He recently passed away, but William Goldman, who wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men. He got Oscars for both of those. The Princess Bride. In his later years, he was probably Hollywood's foremost script doctor. In his first book on screenwriting called Adventures in the Screen Trade, he enumerates Goldman's rule of Hollywood, which is, and I quote, "No one knows anything."
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
That could sum up the world in a whole bunch of categories nowadays.
Yeah, but, you know, the question was, why does this show succeed and this one doesn't? Why do these high-paid executives pick up this one and not that? It was the same with Diners. They had no expectation that it would do well, and it did.
They're still cutting your checks, though, I hope.
No, cable's funny. Cable has no residuals. Cable, you get paid once for each episode, and that's it. And I've got some episodes that I would bet have run 100 times, because I hear from restaurant owners when the repeats run, because business picks up again.
Yeah, it has to. But what happens if they close down?
There are some that have closed, and I've noticed that the Food Network on their website simply lists them as closed since the broadcast.
Wow. It's funny how they keep up with those things, but that's good. So people don't go driving to one of these diners or dives and they're not there anymore. They play the Food Network. They can see you for anything nowadays.
Well, credibility is everything, especially in a show like this where you're telling people, trust me, this is a good restaurant. And on occasion, we would get a complaint from someone who said they went to that restaurant and it wasn't as good as we said in the show. And I would usually call those people back personally to explain. Well, first of all, because I enjoyed their surprise when they realized the executive producer of the show was on the phone. But more importantly, to explain to them that the restaurant was what we said it was at the time we were there.
Yeah, you can't help the future.
If it's gone downhill since then, I'm sorry. More likely, every restaurant can have a bad day. But I always wanted people to realize that there was no BS here. If we said it was good, it was good. We walked out of, during my time there, I directed the crew and guy to walk out of 5% of the restaurants we booked to shoot at, because on closer inspection, when they arrived for the shoot, the places didn't hold up. But 5% is a pretty good batting average.
I mean, part of the title in the show is called Dive, so wouldn't you want to get the shitty places too?
No, you want the food to be good. The premise was that these are terrific places, perhaps innocuously or surprisingly turning out great food. But the deal we made with the viewer, the compact was, we're going to show you some great places.
Now, after 11 years, before we get there, what even made you switch from broadcasting to food?
It was I wanted to eat. I had opened my production company, and no one was buying what I was selling. I had done, when I first opened my production company, and no one was buying anything, I called a friend of mine, Al Roker, who had worked for me when I ran the Weekend Today Show.
I love it, David. Keep throwing those name bombs in on me.
Okay, I'll throw a bunch if you want. but no, Al had worked for me on the Weekend Today show before he was on the main show. And he had a production company. I called him up and said, hey, I'm starving. You got any work? And he said, I'm doing some stuff for the Food Network. You want to do some of that? I said, sure. So he subcontracted a couple of hours for them that I actually did, including one on Diners. You know, long term, I couldn't survive getting the pass-through piece of the check. So at some point I started pitching the network directly, and that was not going at all well. And one day after multiple calls, the executive who I was talking to said to me, don't you have anything else about Diners? And I said, oh yeah, I'm developing a show called Diners, Drive-Ins and Dives. And I told her all about it. And she said, you know, that sounds good. This was like late on a Thursday afternoon. She said, we have a development meeting on Tuesday. Get me a write-up for a one-hour special on Monday. So I was kind of in a quandary when I put down the phone because, no, I wasn't developing a show called Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. I had just invented the name and the show description on the spot.
Hey, some of the best things in life were made that way. Star Wars was made that way.
Go for it. So I spent the weekend calling around to restaurant owners, critics, writers, historians. That was back when actually you would talk to people on a phone. You wouldn't just type. And right. I wrote up a pitch and delivered it on Monday. And they had their meeting Tuesday. And shortly thereafter, they picked up the special. So that's how I ended up in food television.
And what made you leave after 11 years?
Can't get into it. Welcome.
Backstage politics.
Welcome to the world of television.
All right. Say no more. But the book now, you just took your passion and threw it into writing at that point?
Well, look, every few years I get restless and change jobs. It may be going from a foreign news producer to a morning show producer, but I need some new kind of challenge. On top of that, almost every show producer in television thinks he or she could write a book, because writing for television is a unique and somewhat stifling experience, because you can't just sit down and start writing the story. You know, you can't say it was a dark and stormy night and then Oedipus killed his father. What you have to do in writing for television is use the words that work with the pictures you have available and that quietly and seamlessly direct the audience from one moment of reality to another. So for years, I had thought to myself, I could do a book. And finally, after I finished up with Beer Geeks and actually took a little detour into development for a streaming channel, I looked around and said, what now? And I said, you know what? I should probably write that damn book. So I did.
And how's it going? Let's put that up there for these guys to see it also. I got it up here on Amazon. Your book.
Oh, pull it up. Yeah, no, the book has been doing very well so far. We've got a bunch of number one sellers in different Amazon categories. I've gotten a couple of awards for it. A finalist in the International Book Awards, and I got to read the medal, a silver medal in the Living Now Book Awards.
All right.
And people have said very nice things about it. You know, I've got some great blurbs. I got George Stephanopoulos. I got a lot of people who know from journalism or food or both, who've said very nice things about the book. So right now I'm out there promoting it.
Making the tour.
Well, you know, in the world of COVID, the tour is complicated.
Tour is almost all the way virtual nowadays.
It's mostly virtual. I went to Reading, Pennsylvania last week. I'm going to Jacksonville, Florida in a few weeks. I'm going to Ohio. I'm going to Connecticut. But I would say it's split 50-50 between in-person and virtual. Hey, it is what it is.
Doing like Barnes and Nobles and little bookstores like
Actually, the tour I'm on right now is there's an organization called the Jewish Book Council, which has a tour open to either Jewish authors of any topic or authors of any religion who are writing on a Jewish subject. I qualify for both because I'm your quintessential bagel-eating New York Jew, and my book has a chapter on bagels. So they have this big thing at the beginning of the season where everybody, it was done virtually this year. Basically, you get 2 minutes to pitch your book to hundreds of Jewish organizations across the country, usually Jewish community centers or Jewish federations or individual synagogues. I booked, I don't know, a dozen stops, and it's been going very well.
Well, I used to be a big bagel-eating Puerto Rican down there in the Bronx myself, but has been a while since I've been out there. And the bagels, I tell you, are not the same.
They're not. Well, no, of course they're not. Although, look, I actually talked to Marvin Lender, one of the Lender brothers, who's machine-made Lender's bagels, brought the bagel to most of America, and is always criticized for being not bagel-y enough. And Marvin said, of course it isn't. First of all, when you mass produce something, it changes it. And secondly, we changed it specifically to appeal to a Midwestern non-Jewish audience. Not as crunchy, softer, with a variety of sweet flavors that were never seen on the Lower East Side of New York. But hey, it made the bagel an American institution. And now what's happening, and I'm surprised it hasn't come to where you are yet, is there's been a resurgence.
Very well, maybe. I just haven't been out here long enough.
Well, I spent about 6 months in your neck of the woods a few years ago, and it wasn't there yet. What's happened is there's been an artisanal bagel renaissance in much of the country, in places that are not traditionally bagel land, where people are actually hand-making bagels the traditional way. There's a deli in Denver called Rosenberg's Bagels and Deli, where not only do they hand make bagels the old fashioned way, but, and pardon me as I clear my throat, they're also treating the water they boil them in, because proper bagels are boiled, not just baked. They're treating the water to mimic the mineral content of water in New York City. Because
people need to take that all around the world and make better pizza.
Well, the pizza industry is also undergoing an artisanal movement with pizzeria owners starting to care a lot more about the quality of their ingredients, the specific protein levels of the wheat they're using, which differs depending upon the kind of dough you're trying to create. I, for the book, was allowed to take part in a pizza making school. Tony Gemignani, one of the leading lights of pizza in America, runs the International Pizza School in San Francisco. And when I was there, and I spent 3 or 4 out of the 5 or 6 days allotted to the course, everyone else in the class was a professional looking to up their game. I was the only civilian, and I was also the in terms of pizza making, the dumbest kid in class. I mean, making pizza by hand for real looks real simple. Like you just throw it in the oven and take it out. Believe me, it's not.
I believe you. I've tried to make one or two of them myself in the house. It just doesn't, it doesn't pan out.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. You need to know what you're doing. Yes, I understand.
So what else are you working on now besides the book tour?
I'm working on another book called Eating While Standing, about the various ways our mobile hurry-up culture has chosen to eat. Everything from grab-and-go breakfast at the convenience store to food trucks to amusement parks and state fairs. I recently spent a few days at the Minnesota State Fair chronicling such delights as obviously deep-fried candy bars and pork chops on a stick.
Pork chops on a stick. I've never encountered one of those.
Well, let me explain. It's a pork chop. They put it on a stick. Have a nice day. They also have spaghetti and meatballs on a stick. They have all sorts of bizarre deep-fried ravioli that are filled with God knows what. And we spent some time with the woman known as Sweet Martha, who is the top-rated food vendor at the Minnesota State Fair. The numbers were down this year because of COVID, and they didn't have the fair last year. But the year before that, selling chocolate chip cookies in 12 days, she brought in $5 million.
Wow. In 12 days just selling cookies?
That's it.
All right. Where's my daughter and my wife? We're doing something wrong.
Yeah, well, there you go.
We need to not be podcasting. We need to be making cookies.
Well, she's been there for a number of years, but year after year, she's the top vendor in terms of revenue.
Now, I'm no TV genius, but mm-hmm. Eating While Standing sounds like a great show.
Let me write books for a while.
How many books you think you got in you before you head back to TV?
I don't think I'm going back to TV. I'm 67. Let's assume I live to 120. I got a good 10 books in me.
Okay, that sounds about right. I mean, what if you get a good sounding, great podcast host that you feel like he can be on TV? Why not create a show?
It's you want a serious answer, all joking aside? What has happened to TV over the last few years is it is much, much, much more about finding a celebrity host than it is about the content of the show.
Oh, yeah.
Any celebrity who wants to do a food show can get a food show. But proposing a food show just because it's a great show, if you don't have Justin Bieber to front it, it's not going to go anywhere.
I hear you. And that's most of the reason why a lot of podcasts right now aren't making it, because everybody now has a podcast.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because TV has traditionally been voyeurism, about spending time with someone you want to spend time with, spending time with someone you want to hang out with. Right. Diners.
Netflix and chill.
Yeah, the whole ethos of diners is you're on this road trip with your buddy Guy. It's interesting in terms of picking celebrities. There are celebrities people want to spend time with. There are also some celebrities who can come off as terribly annoying when they don't have a written script in front of them. So you got to get the right famous person into the right vehicle.
Not everybody can just slip off the top of their head and
no, go not at all. Comes out their not, mouth. Not, yeah. Not at all. Not at all.
Yes, it's very hard. So you don't miss the TV business at all, huh?
No, it's physically hard. You know, the reality of making television, and I hesitate to raise this because it's such a sad subject, but the story of what happened on that movie set with Alec Baldwin, Live Gun, as they start to unpack what was going on that set, it was an independent film, and I have no idea if this has any relationship to the incident, but the complaints coming out of the set from crew members are that they were being asked, or if you wanted the job ordered, to work insanely long hours and commute from a hotel 50 miles away. The fact of the matter is, when you're making TV, you're constrained by your budget. I, with the help of trusted crew members who knew this was going to be a bear, could only make the quality of TV I wanted to make by working insane hours against the budget that we had been, that had been agreed to with the network or syndicator. It's physically hard work. It's extremely hard work. And especially on an independent or small production, I don't care if you're the executive producer. If you're trying to hurry from one setup to the other, you end up carrying light stands and sandbags. And unlike the rest of the crew, when you get back to the hotel for 4 hours of sleep, you're up for an hour or two planning tomorrow. So it's a lot easier.
Long day, short night.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to sit in my little office here in front of my typewriter with half a bottle of red wine and say, how shall I start this chapter?
It does sound about right. Do you see yourself getting into other genres?
I don't know the answer to that. And I think the public will tell me. Well, the publisher, thinking of what the public will want, will tell me that. There are some other topics I'd like to tiptoe into, but I truly don't know if the market will say to someone who is a known commodity in the world of food, sure, try that. You know, I say it takes celebrity to get a TV gig. Frankly, what tiny little bit of celebrity I might have in the food world, I'm sure is what finalized this deal for me, so that you can put on the front of the book by David Page, the creator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. There's something for the public to latch onto, some kind of notoriety.
Right. It's a visual draw.
Yeah, you know, not that I consider myself any kind of celebrity, but I'm obviously...
Oh, you very well are, sir. Celebrities aren't just in front of the camera.
Well, the point is this. I believe that what pushed this book across the edge to being picked up by a publisher was who I am. I happen to think it's a terrific book. I'm very proud of my writing. I'm very proud of the book. But let's be clear, from a commercial standpoint, that's the marketing pitch.
Right.
I don't know if that will carry over to some other subjects kicking around in the back of my head.
I mean, what other subjects you got kicking around back there?
Well, I used to run the consumer investigative unit at 2020. And there are a number of consumer-related issues that I'd love to put pen to paper, or more specifically, electrons to keyboard, about the fact that service in the country's gone to hell and why that's happened and how you can beat that. But I truly don't know if anyone would be interested in it. I am.
It just sounds like gems. You're just spitting gems all over the place. And I'm very honored that you're doing it here.
Well, there you go. If any publishers want to pick that one up, let me know.
Definitely. Call David. Let him know what you feel. What are some of your passions when you were in the movie industry? The TV industry that maybe you didn't get into?
Oh, I was very lucky because in television, if you work it right, you can explore virtually any topic. It depends how you approach it. When I was overseas, I know one year we were asked. We were assigned to do what is historically the most boring story on earth, which is the advance piece leading up to the annual NATO summit, where the leaders of the NATO countries come together, usually in Brussels, and it's boring enough, but doing a piece about the fact that it's going to happen is like just taking a shot of some sleep drug. Anyway, they told us to do that story, and I sat down one day and I said to myself, how the hell are we going to make this interesting? And then the light went off and I said, what's the smallest army in NATO? I looked into it. It turned out the smallest army in NATO was the Army of Luxembourg. 600 soldiers, so small that the guy who ran it, the chief of staff, wasn't even a general. He was a colonel. And the defense minister was also the minister of agriculture. So we went to profile that. And along with the fun of being on the Milk Day parade with him as he threw cartons of milk from a float, we came we realized that this was a microcosm of the New World, in that the people we talked to in Luxembourg, especially of a certain age who remembered World War II, and this was at the time that Germany had reunified and was becoming the dominant force in Europe again, the people in Luxembourg, when we interviewed them, were not so thrilled with the idea of being so close to Germany, because their country had been plundered by the Nazis, and they weren't so quick to say everything's hunky-dory. There's a massive American military cemetery in Luxembourg. General Patton is buried there after ignominiously dying in a Jeep accident. So we were able to create a highly educational story that exposed a serious issue at the same time that we were able to make it entertaining as hell, because when do you see government ministers throwing milk cartons? And after we finished shooting, the last day of our shooting there, we were exhausted, we were filthy, we had been crawling around in a field somewhere covered with mud, and we're driving back to Luxembourg City, and we see a sign to a restaurant. And we're hungry, so we pull off, we go to the restaurant. Well, we walk in and realize we are dramatically underdressed. This is an haute cuisine European restaurant of the highest order. And before we figured out whether we should leave, the owner came to greet us, who it turned out was an expatriate who had lived in Tucson, who greeted us like his lost-long relatives, fed us an ungodly meal, uncorked his special vintage champagne from the cellar. It was one of the great meals of my life and a wonderful experience. That's a long ramble from the question you asked me, but hey, what the hell?
No, it was good. It shows that sometimes you can dig gold out of a shit situation.
You can. I mean, look, when... before the wall fell, when there was an increasing amount of unrest in the East Bloc, we were trying to figure out a way to visualize the kind of life East Berlin residents lived. So with a translator, I just started knocking on doors on apartment houses that backed up to the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was basically in their backyard. Wow. And we ended up, just by randomly knocking on doors, finding a family to profile. Their kids would kick a soccer ball in the backyard off the Berlin Wall. And they had their hopes and their dreams. And after the wall opened, we went back to that family to see how life was going. And they were a little disappointed because their relatives in the West had not been so quick to say, come on down, have some money. It was a complex human story. And I was delighted that just by journalistic shoe leather of knocking on doors, we were able to come up with it.
Now, David, it seems to me that you keep up on this writing journey and thinking of other topics to write down. And the real thing you should be writing down is your autobiography. You seem to have a lot of interesting stories in your repertoire.
I have a tremendous number of interesting stories, none of which reach the interest level of the autobiographies done by famous war correspondents like Bob Simon. So I'll tell mine to my friends. I do a little talking about overseas experiences when I'm on the book tour. But as my daughter, who's now 28, said to me one day when she was like 8 or 9, Dad, How come every time you talk about a place you've been, you start by talking about the food? So, I got plenty of food. So here's one. Back when the PLO had not yet achieved political legitimacy and it was still considered officially by the U.S. State Department a terrorist organization, we went into, I think it was Tunisia, I don't quite remember. Anyway, we went into a country to interview Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO. And the steps you go through before an Arafat interview included having a meal. And he would do things at odd hours. So we found ourselves, me and the correspondent and the crew, we found ourselves at a long table eating breakfast at 2 or 3 in the morning with Arafat and his retinue. Now, at that time, the PLO did not recognize the state of Israel. It did not exist. You could not say the word. The closest they would ever get in a public statement, if pressed, was to refer to the Zionist entity. But the word Israel did not exist in their vocabulary. We're halfway through breakfast and it's going fine. And then the sound man, and by the way, it's always the sound man. The sound man reaches across the table to a bowl of fruit and announces in jubilation, "Oh, look, blood oranges. I haven't had a blood orange since I was in Israel." Kind of like the old E.F. Hutton commercials, the table came to a silent halt for probably, 5 seconds. It felt like a year. Yeah, and then everyone went on talking as if this had simply not happened.
Because they wish it hadn't.
It didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
Well, he's lucky he left there with his blood oranges intact.
Right, a funny story about Arafat. I guess it was after the interview, I was covering a demonstration. He was speaking and it was all down, down, America. And it was starting to get a little rough in the crowd. And I'm separated from the crew. I'm by myself. And I'm starting to get a little, nervous. And he catches my eye and he winks, telling me, "Relax, dude, this is just for show."
He's letting you know that you were safe.
Yeah, although things did get a little rough later.
I bet. We have to have you on again for some of these stories.
I'd love to. Anytime you want. As I told you before we started, I love to chat about my favorite things: food, travel, books, television, and especially me.
And that's some of our favorite things too, especially the last one. Well, there you go.
Thank you.
Well, we want to thank you very much for coming on, sir. We appreciate your time. We know you're a busy man. We do want to try to get one of those signed copies of your book, though, so we'll be in touch about that.
I would be glad to.
We'll talk off screen in a second. Let me just let the viewer know. You can catch us again tomorrow night. We're going to be live in the break room. We're going to talk about horror icons, the old ones and the remakes. So come and enjoy that for the Halloween topics this month. Again, we had a great guest in David Page, and we hope to have him on again. Junkers, thank you for coming on. David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. I'll come back anytime you want.
It's our pleasure.
Oh, and plug Food Americana.
Oh, definitely. Food Americana. We'll be putting a post up shortly or tomorrow morning about where you can get the book. Obviously, you can get an Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever your books are sold. But it's even better when we tell you where to get it. So wait for our post. We'll let you know. We'll put the links in there on Facebook, on our Instagram. And be sure to look out for David's second book when it does come out. And third, fourth, fifth, all the way to that 10th. We're going to look for all 10 of those books. We're definitely going to be David Page enthusiasts after these.
Well, Jason, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, the pleasure was all ours. We enjoyed your time, and thank you again, sir.
Excellent.
Junkers, see you tomorrow. Yo!
Welcome to Talking Junk.
I'm your host, Jason Melendez.